welcome to Let's Build, the podcast where we talk about building strength, stability, and self-reliance through affordable housing. I'm your host, Kirsten Pittman, Community Outreach Coordinator for Central Valley Habitat for Humanity in Bridgewater, Virginia. And today we're going to talk about gentrification and how it can be the arch enemy of both diversity and affordable housing due to displacement and resegregation of communities. We'll cover the signs that a city may be falling prey to gentrification and why governing bodies should carefully assess their actions before falling into the pitfalls of this and putting their low-income community members in between a rock and a hard place. I will be covering this in two parts because it is such an extensive topic and I want to be able to give an all-around picture of what gentrification is. And in the next episode, we'll cover programs and strategies for avoiding it and why some of them won't work in our area. I also wanted to share that since we talked about the federal eviction moratorium in a previous episode, the ban has run out. There was some debate about who could reinstate it, and in the end, the CDC has issued an extension to October 3rd. This is only in counties experiencing substantial and high levels of community transmission of COVID-19, which will cover an estimated 90% of renters, according to Senator Chuck Schumer, of a Democrat in New York. Unless something else changes before then, we can expect to see an increase in our community members in need due to a loss of housing, and in a future episode, we may cover how people losing their homes is benefiting real estate agencies, landlords, and those that can afford to buy at a premium price. With that, let's talk about gentrification. Today, we're going to talk about neighborhood change and how it can affect the populations that live in those areas, especially when it comes to low-income housing. When we think of neighborhood change in urban areas, you might think of new amenities like restaurants, stores, gyms, and more, but who is making and influencing these decisions, and will the current residents of the neighborhood even be able to afford to use these new amenities? According to the Displacement of Lower-Income Families in Urban Areas report by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, gentrification is a form of neighborhood change that occurs when a higher-income group moves into a lower-income area, potentially altering the cultural and financial landscape of the original neighborhood. Let's unpack this a little bit. In urban areas, land can be invaluable to businesses and developers interested in expanding their reach and ultimately their profits. However, if they have to choose between land that costs a premium and land that is extremely cheap, they most likely will be choosing the cheap option. On the National Low-Income Housing Coalition's website, they define gentrification as a profit-driven race and class change of a historically disinvested neighborhood. Disinvested in this context means areas that businesses and governments have abandoned, where there has been little new development or maintenance of existing buildings or institutions. These disinvested neighborhoods, many of which were segregated in the past or previously the cultural centers for minority groups, are usually the targets of companies choosing what they consider to be the cheaper option. Long story short, this is happening where land is cheap and the chance to make a profit is high due to the influx of wealthier individuals willing to pay higher rents. However, when this occurred in other areas, land values can quickly skyrocket and housing prices dramatically increased, as well as the pressure on property owners to get the most money out of their tenants. While this can create economic development in these disinvested areas, the wealth is only going to a very small amount of people. According to that same website, the upper layers of the labor force are getting paid very well, allowing them to outbid ordinary work people, the elderly, and people with disabilities for homes. As an area becomes gentrified and amenities are going in and repairs and new builds are cropping up, the wealthier individuals moving into that area that have the ability to pay high rents can easily price the already existing low-income residents out of the area. As these residents are forced to move to areas with lower prices, the new, wealthier residents are able to gain political power that would have previously been in the hands of the low-income residents. Race is tied to class and power in gentrification, In other areas, such as the Bay Area in California, which has experienced heavy gentrification in the past 20 years, most of the wealthy and well-paid are white, while those being displaced are people of color, who typically have less income to bid for housing and are more often renters at greater risk of eviction. The elite can hold on to their claims to the city because they also hold the political power. With current residents leaving because the cost of living became too expensive and new, wealthier residents are moving in, the electoral and financial power also shifts as they vote in people that look and think the way that they do. This leaves low-income and minority households with few options through which to claim rights to the city and remain in their communities. Many of these communities have historically been victims of what's called redlining. According to the Urban Displacement Project, from the 1930s through the late 1960s, standards set by the federal government and carried out by banks explicitly labeled neighborhoods home to predominantly people of color as risky and unfit for investment. This practice meant that people of color were denied access to loans that would enable them to buy or repair homes in their neighborhoods. Similarly, around this same time, something called white flight was occurring in urban areas. This was caused by housing and transportation policies that fueled the growth of mostly white suburbs and the exodus of capital from urban centers. This led to disinvested neighborhoods that operated without much governmental support for a long time, and now these neighborhoods are being targeted by those aiming to redevelop them to make a profit, without consideration for their residents or how they will be affected. This isn't a new problem. These neighborhoods have been targeted for many years due to the cheap land cost, and the foreclosure crisis has only expedited the process for land grabs by large developers. In low-income communities of color, disproportionate levels of subprime lending resulted in mass foreclosures, leaving those neighborhoods vulnerable to investors seeking to purchase and flip homes. And when a home is flipped, there is no guarantee, and most likely it will not be affordable housing. So, what are some of the key factors to look out for when identifying gentrification? The Urban Displacement Project outlines a few, including real estate speculation with investors flipping properties for large profits, as well as high-end development and landlords looking for higher-paying tenants. Increased investment in neighborhood amenities like transit and parks, changes in land use, for example, from industrial land to restaurants and storefronts, and changes in the character of the neighborhood as community-run businesses are replaced by businesses catering to new residents' needs. You might be thinking that this only occurs in large-scale urban areas like New York City or the Bay Area in California, but this can really happen anywhere. Using those same red flags, we can examine our largest urban area, the city of Harrisonburg, and make some comparisons. In the 90s and early 2000s, the downtown center of Harrisonburg was largely full of empty storefronts, and it wasn't much of a walking district. I remember visiting the regional library with my family, and occasionally we would go out to eat at one of the restaurants that had been there for as long as I or anyone else could remember. In more recent years, this has become a huge walking district with cultural and historical information, tiny cafes and coffee houses, small boutiques, and the city has been working on improving the infrastructure and design of the area to draw in more crowds, namely the ever-growing population of college students that we have from August through May. According to city officials, college students make up 37% of the population growth and demand increases in the city. There has been an increased demand for green spaces, parks, bike lanes, and the transit system in recent years. There have been zoning changes, and the apartments are no longer affordable in downtown. However, just a few blocks away from the city center is some of the historically most low-income housing in the area. On the surface, this checks all the boxes for identifying gentrification. Rent is no longer affordable and is costing many of the low-income families in our area more than 50% of their monthly income. New grocery stores, industrial urban loft apartments, bars, and stores are going in all the time. Residents that 15 years ago would have been able to afford the low-income housing in the downtown area can't afford to live there anymore. The average rent for a studio apartment in our area in general is $925 a month. For an apartment in a building that previously supported low-income housing in downtown Harrisonburg, the rent is now $1,395 a month for this two-bedroom, one-bath apartment. For this to be considered affordable and only cost 30% of a single person's income, they would need to be making approximately $55,800 a year after taxes. Single individuals that qualify for our program are making approximately $30,000 a year. Someone considered very low income, making 50% of the area's median income, would only be making about $25,000. In 2010, this would have been closer to $600 to $800 per month, not accounting for cheaper prices for low-income housing and only accounting for rent inflation. The city put out a news release on August 3rd about the City Eyes Master Plan for Downtown, called Downtown 2040. The release on the Harrisonburg-Rockingham Chamber of Commerce website will be linked in the show notes. And according to the release, Interface Studio is the consulting group that the city is partnering with for the project. The studio's principal, Scott Page, called it a community-based urban design firm and said the team is taking a grassroots approach to brainstorming the vision for downtown. The studio is working with the city to build a comprehensive plan for downtown, which will be presented after research concludes in the fall. Regarding this release, I started to wonder if this consulting group, which claims to be using a community-based urban planning model, would actually be acknowledging the history of the downtown area and addressing the changes needed to avoid gentrification. We know so far that in the past, the city of Harrisonburg has encroached on historically segregated areas of the city with cheap land costs and created displacement in those communities. So would they be willing to acknowledge this as we approach new planning areas for downtown? Further on in the release, the studio's principal, Scott Page, states past development projects have gone on at the expense of communities such as the Northeast neighborhood, a historically Black area. Page said previous projects were also misguided. The projects were misguided in that they assumed downtown should be car-centric, Page said. They were racist in that they were built on top of existing Black neighborhoods. The steering committee for the initiative is made up of a cross-section of the Harrisonburg community, including leaders from businesses, the Northeast Neighborhood Association, church ministers, and more. With this information, I was slightly more reassured because, as we'll discuss later, one of the top strategies for preventing displacement through gentrification is for city officials, community leaders, and the communities themselves to work together with nonprofit representation to make sure they aren't driven or priced out of the neighborhoods, and instead are able to stay and take advantage of the new amenities and increased quality of life that they can experience from living in a stable area. As the city moves forward with this comprehensive plan, nonprofits like ours that work with the most vulnerable members of our population will be watching closely, and I'm sure the community members will be as well. So while we wait and see what our local area has planned to avoid gentrification, what is happening to those that can no longer live in already gentrified areas? The Urban Displacement Project says, while increased investment in an area can be positive, gentrification is often associated with displacement, which means that in some of these communities, long-term residents are not able to stay to benefit from new investments in housing, healthy food access, or transit infrastructure. Another impact of displacement to consider is cultural displacement. Even for long-time residents who are able to stay in newly gentrifying areas, changes in the makeup and character of a neighborhood can lead to a reduced sense of belonging or feeling out of place in their own home. One article on planning theory and practice states, "Research suggests that long-term residents of gentrifying neighborhoods face more than just direct displacement, such as eviction or dramatic rent increases. Rather, they also face collective displacement, the prevention of future low-income residents to live in the neighborhood, and political, social, and cultural displacement. As new residents move into formerly disinvested neighborhoods, low-income residents have fought to stay and resisted displacement, resulting in contests for space and community control as government agencies, new residents, and developers turn to public-private partnerships to spur investments as the antidote to declining tax bases, poverty, and crime in urban neighborhoods. The ability to control public spaces, housing, or governance in a community can change the way that communities are experienced and understood. This goes back to the loss of electoral and financial power for these communities. If the long-term residents no longer have a voice in the process and the government, the door is left open for them to be ignored and for more informal red tape-skipping arrangements that can be made by large investors and other groups. In an article called Planning for Empowerment, Upending the Traditional Approach to Planning for Affordable Housing in the Face of Gentrification, the author presents the following. Typically, certain groups have a privileged voice in local government. Regime politics are informal arrangements that surround and complement the formal workings of governmental authority and are often centered on a pro-growth agenda with an emphasis on the central business district over neighborhoods. These regimes are characterized by relatively stable informal arrangements with local governments that give groups special access to local government actors. They're often led by developers and landowners, meaning that state and local governments face particular pressure in the implementation of federal and local housing policies. Because land regulations are largely local or state controlled, real estate developers lobby at the local and state level for zoning changes, beneficial regulation, or for support in particular land deals. As a result, the top-down sites of planning crystallize around city planning offices, developers, and elected officials. This can be particularly challenging in the context of redevelopment and gentrification, in which new and old residents, particularly low-income renters, experience unequal access to processes, elected officials, and agency staff. Basically, when an area becomes or starts the process of gentrification, those with political power and money are able to circumvent the normal processes of government and exclude voices of community members that would disagree. In short, backroom political deals. These types of deals and increasing amenities can lead to underhanded and illegal actions by those who hold valuable property in these areas. One article on affordable housing in New York City goes so far as to speculate, in some cases, landlords will go to extreme measures to bully the tenants in an attempt to drive them from the housing unit. For instance, landlords may stop accepting rent and take the matter to court, give misinformation on secession rights, abuse construction practices, and more. Many of the rent-stabilized tenants do not wish to leave these neighborhoods. The low-income residents then remain in the neighborhood by living in substandard housing or paying a larger percentage of their income for rent. These individuals can encounter a lot of resistance to staying, and in many cases just can't afford it. Or, as the quote suggests, many pay more for their income on rent. We've established that any more than 30% is unaffordable. So in order to stay, they have to pay more than they should. Some studies use exit rates of people from these communities to try and communicate how many people end up leaving. But these aren't always accurate. The displacement study states, not only do exit rates fail to capture the limited choices of low-income households to cope with rising housing costs, but also the exclusionary effects of gentrification. For families looking to move into areas of opportunity, some neighborhoods are inaccessible because of high rents, forcing low-income households to lower-cost neighborhoods with less investment than gentrified neighborhoods. If your first thought was that they should live within their means in low-cost neighborhoods without the investments, amenities, and services that gentrified neighborhoods enjoy, you are part of the problem and may have an inner bias towards poverty that needs addressed. These low-income families that are forced out of their neighborhoods because someone wealthy came in and purchased the land, marketed it towards other wealthy people, and then built amenities that only wealthy people can afford. These families that face this displacement are at a greater risk of moving to neighborhoods that are worse off than the original neighborhood in terms of home values, unemployment rates, median incomes, and public school performance. This is the end of part one of gentrification and how it can be affordable housing's worst enemy. In the next episode, we'll be covering gentrification part two and the strategies and steps that can be taken to avoid it. However, some of these are not able to be implemented in our area, and we'll cover why that is as well. With that, we're coming to the end of today's episode, so we'll finish it out with a quote from Sarah Schulman. Gentrification replaces most people's experiences with the perceptions of the privileged and calls that reality. The takeaways from today are that gentrification is a form of neighborhood change that occurs when land is cheap and possibly has a history of being disinvested, and wealthier households move into these areas and create amenities and housing that only they can afford, often excluding and displacing communities already present politically, financially, and physically. We covered real-life examples from the city that we serve in our area and what they're doing to recognize the mistakes of the past. Come back for part 2 in episode 8. Thank you for listening today. Come build with us over on Facebook and Instagram at Central Valley Habitat or at Central Valley VA on Twitter. We're always looking for volunteers, so if you think Habitat is for you, check us out on our website, www.centralvalleyhabitat.org. I've been your host, Kirsten Pittman, with Central Valley Habitat for Humanity. Let's get out there and build. Until next time.